Steve Lamb, alcoholic. Oh, God, it's good to be here. It's good to be sober. And can I get a sense, is there anybody here in their first year? Anybody? Oh, welcome, guys. Welcome. Buckle up. You're in for a ride. You really are. And I want to thank the committee for inviting me here. I've come here a number of years. It took me a while to get in. They wouldn't let me in for a while, but I finally got in here. And it's really an honor and a privilege to share with you. It really is. It's always an honor and a privilege to share in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it really, really is here. Because like what was said earlier today, there are so many of my heroes that I respect in this room. And they have really gone to untold lengths to remind me before I talked, A, not to screw up. B, if I run out of time, they're more than happy to come up here and fill in the time. And C, just have fun. And that's what I intend to do. I would like to take one brief moment of silence, though, for the alcoholic both in here and out there who's still suffering, and for our brothers that didn't make it here this weekend and will hopefully be here next year. Thank you. As most of you who know me know, I'm not an authority in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't appointed. I wasn't anointed. I'm just the guy that's here to share his experience with you this weekend. And you're here to have your experience. Not mine, not your sponsors, not the person to your left or right, but your experience. And I got that experience through the steps. But it didn't start that way. My sobriety date is July 27th, 1996. I've been sober 25 years and some change. And when I got here on a court card. And I didn't want to be here. I got pulled over by the California Highway Patrol, and initially things were going pretty well. I was having a conversation with him. I'd done the field sobriety test. I'd done the alphabet backwards. I actually kind of thought we were bonding. Things were going pretty good. And then the Highway Patrol officer asked me a question that, to this day, I still feel is just completely unfair. He asked me, what freeway are you on? Yeah, I mean, I'm busy. I'm not paying attention to that. And I'm from Southern California, and the main freeway there is the 405, which runs north-south. I guess that I was on the 405. I was on the 91, which is perpendicular to that. I have no idea what I was doing on the 91, okay? But I got pulled into court. I got sentenced to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. They sentenced me to go to six AA meetings in 6 months. I know. I mean, I thought that was excessive, you know, and because I have delusions, I got a busy social calendar. I'm not sure how I could fit that in, so I wait till I got like 5 weeks left to do six AA meetings. And in my mind, that's like more than one a week. I don't know how could anybody do that, right? So I went to my first AA meeting and I've been sober ever since. And it wasn't the plan, it wasn't the design. I didn't much like you. I don't think you really cared for me, frankly, when I got here. You kept telling me to come back, but I really didn't believe you. I really didn't. But what happened to me was you told my story. And Alcoholics Anonymous is a society, it's a society of storytellers. We tell our stories. And the crazy thing about it was the facts and circumstances were different, but it was my story. You talked about an inability to control and enjoy your drinking. You talked about this physical obsession that you had, this reaction that you had to alcohol. But you more importantly talked about the mental obsession. And I got it. I got it. I'm the kind of alcoholic. Before I came to you, what would typically happen to me is my wife would send me out to get milk. Now it is really not a complicated task. There's like three or four subparts to it, right? You got to leave the house, you got to go to the store, you got to buy the milk, and you got to come home with the milk. And I'm pretty good at the first two or three parts, but the whole coming home with the milk part, not so good. Because what happens is I go out to the store and I run into one of you. You know, I run into Bob. He looks benign, but just because he's in a supine position, don't believe it, you know, or Darren, he's from Australia. He doesn't even speak English, but you know, these are guys, you know, and they'll say something to me like, would you like to have a beer? Well, of course I'd like to have a beer. I mean, it's like a basic food group. It's not even really drinking, right? So we go have a beer, but I'm an alcoholic and it does not quench my thirst. I get thirstier. And it's never enough, and I want to get there. I don't even know where there is, but I want to get there, and I want to get there now. So I like a little supplement. I like tequila. So I'm drinking beer and shoot tequila. 3 days later, I come to. I used to call it time travel. I now realize it's blacking out. It's a skill set that many of us have. Non-alcoholics are not impressed with it. We're kind of fond of it. You know, it saves a lot of time. We meet interesting people. You know, it's, and I'm selfish and I'm self-centered, but I'm not entirely inconsiderate. So when I come to after 3 days, I realize, oh man, I gotta get the milk, right? So I run to the store and I buy the milk and I come home to my wife, Lynn, and I'm all proud because I got the milk. I'm like, hey baby, I got the milk. My wife, Lynn, is not impressed. She's not annoyed. She is seriously pissed off because I have been gone for 3 days. You know, and this is how I drink. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and I hear my story and I hear you and I realize I got to stop drinking. I got to stop drinking. This is not where I got to stop drinking. So I stop drinking. And I'm the kind of guy, I hear what I want to hear when I want to hear it. And what I don't want to hear, I don't hear it. And what I'm hearing is just go to meetings. Meetings, meetings, meetings. Meeting makers make it. 90 meetings in 90 days. Now, there are other people, you know, guys like Curtis and Steve and, you know, Bill that are talking about the steps. They're talking about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They're talking about the program of recovery. They're talking about a sponsor. They're talking about God or a higher power, if you prefer that term. But, like, I'm not drinking here, you know. I don't want to overreact, okay? I'm not an extra credit guy. The last thing I want to do, I certainly don't want to get over sober, right, you know. So I'm sitting there because other people that have been around a while, they're telling me, you know, don't leave before the miracle. So I'm like hunkered down, waiting for the miracle. And I'm sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to meetings, 1, 2, 3 meetings a day. And I'm getting progressively worse. I am suffering from untreated alcoholism. Or probably more accurately, you are suffering from my untreated alcoholism. You know, I'm like a jerk at work. I'm a jerk at home. I'm a jerk in meetings. I come into the meetings and the old timers look at me and they're like, lamb. Just sit in the corner and for God's sakes, don't talk to any newcomers because they still have hope. You know, it was just, it was bad, right? And I went about 100 days stark raving sober. And then I'm a trial lawyer by trade, so I went on a business trip to go do some depositions in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to get ready for a trial. I'm supposed to be there all week. I get done around midweek. I go back to my hotel room, and in the hotel room, I have an honor bar. Now, I am a newcomer. I have no honor, but they've given me this little mini fridge. I got the key to it, and it doesn't have everything I want and need in it, but it's like a really good start. I mean, 2 by 2 by 2, there's bourbon, there's gin, there's no tequila, which was annoying, but there's beers, domestics, imports, and I'm opening and shutting it because I want to drink. And if any of you have ever seen the movie Flight with Denzel Washington, you know those honor bars, they talk to you. We're having a conversation, right? It wants me to drink. I'm opening and shutting the honor bar. I do a little inventory. I arrange the domestics and the imports. And I'm getting nervous. I'm afraid I'm going to drink. And I know if I drink, it's not going to go well. It's not going to go well. I'm probably not going to make it back to L.A., certainly not for at least 3 or 4 days. And I love the big book. I love the 12 and 12. But when I finally got a sponsor, one of the things that my sponsor had me do was listen to a series of talks that a guy named Chuck Chamberlain did in 1975 at a retreat like this. And before he died in the 80s, one of his sponsees had those talks transcribed. They put it in a book called The New Pair of Glasses. And at that particular retreat in the book, Chuck had a tendency, he liked to draw this drawing, one simple drawing on the blackboard. And it's in the book. And what Chuck did was, he drew a circle, and inside the circle, he put all the people, plants, and animals in the universe inside the circle of life. And then Chuck put life, good, God, whatever your concept of a higher power is, inside the circle of life. And then he drew a stick man outside the circle, separate and apart. And that was Chuck, and that was me. And then he drew a thin line that he identified as ego or conscious separation from God, which keeps us outside the circle of life. And that was my story before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and for quite some time afterwards. Because I hadn't done the steps. I hadn't had the psychic change, the spiritual awakening, the spiritual experience, whatever phrase you want to use. I hadn't had my concept of reality change. Now the reality is, it is both physically and spiritually impossible for there to be lamb outside the entire circle of life. I'm inside the circle. You're inside the circle. We're all inside the circle. And the greater reality is there is no edge to the circle. But I cannot see that at this time, and I certainly can't demonstrate it. I'm out of my mind. But I don't drink. And I don't, you could call it the dumb luck of the alcoholic. Norm Alpe used to call it seconds and inches. I believe it's the grace of God, but I would have never, ever used that phrase back then. I go downstairs, I get in a car, I go out to the airport, I fly home, I get up the next morning, and I've got a newcomer plan. And if you're new, I guarantee you, you've got a newcomer plan. And we all think our newcomer plans are brilliant. I thought mine was brilliant. I've been around a while. I've heard a lot of newcomer plans. I'm convinced that they are all shrouded in a cloud of stupidity that the creator of the plan cannot possibly fathom. And if you're here and you've got a newcomer plan, I really strongly encourage you to speak to one of the guys who've been around a while. Tell them your newcomer plan this weekend. And after they stop laughing, hopefully they'll be able to dissuade you from your newcomer plan. But mine was a brilliant plan. It was this. I was in the Army from 1980 to 1993. I'd gone through airborne school. I went through Ranger school. I went off to Korea for a year. I got selected to go through selection and assessment, became a Green Beret for a while. They eventually sent me to law school. I served 13 and a half years. I was a JAG when I got out. My last job was I was in the Pentagon. And my job was I was the intelligence oversight advisor for the United States Army, which should concern you. And through my travels, I'd acquired some things. And I didn't have a big book. I didn't know anything about this rigorous honesty thing, right? And I kept it. I didn't even think of it as stealing at the time. I just thought it might come in handy one day. And I had a kit bag. We call it a go bag. I had some weapons, some demolition, and I had 13 passports. And these passports have got my photograph, but they're different names and they're from different countries. And I'd use these for God and country while I was in the Army, and I just didn't turn them in. And today I need them. I need them today because I got this newcomer plan. My newcomer plan is this. I'm going to take my regular American passport, my blue passport that has my photograph, my name on it. And I'm going to leave the country. It's important to leave the country on your name. I'm going to fly up to British Columbia. When I get up to British Columbia, I'm going to head east for a week or two. I'm going to start flipping passports, flipping identities. I'll come back to British Columbia. Steve Lamb will cease to exist. Then my plan is I got some former associates of mine that are doing some kind of interesting marketing and distribution down in Costa Rica. So I'm going to head down to Costa Rica. Now, I got a wife and I got a daughter, but I don't discuss the plan with them because, you know, it's a career move, right? They're not involved with this, right? And I lay all this stuff out, and the 13 passports that I should have turned in 1993, they're all current. They haven't expired. But my regular U.S. passport, my blue passport, has expired. So I'm like, oh, man, I can't believe it. I can't execute this brilliant plan. I didn't know what to do. I went to a meeting. I met a guy there named Jim. He became my grand sponsor for a while before he passed away. And he became my grand sponsor, by the way, without my permission. Because what happened was Jim was talking about sponsorship in the meeting. And I felt like I'd done everything, but I hadn't done that. So I went up to Jim after the meeting, and I looked at him in the shoes because I couldn't look at him in the face. And I said, Jim, I heard you talking about sponsorship. I've been around for about 100 days. I think it's time that I interview for a sponsor. And now, if you've been around a while, you know that sounds ridiculous, right? But when you're new, what I heard was find somebody that has what you want. Well, I don't know about you, but I got a complex set of social issues. Not anybody can sponsor this, right? And I obviously am the only person that's qualified to ascertain who should sponsor me, right? So there has to be an interview process, right? And Jim is looking at me like, Emmanuel, you're pathetic. And he grabs me by the shoulder. He takes me outside. He introduces me to a guy I've never met before. He says, Michael, Steve, Michael, sponsor, sponsee, go with God. And he walks away laughing. Yeah. And I'm thinking, this ain't funny. This isn't even, I don't even know this guy. You know, Bill knows him. He's younger than me. I've never heard his story. And Michael's all excited because he's just been delivered a new fish. So he reaches in his pocket. He gets out a piece of paper and a pencil, and he writes his address and his phone number. And he says, I want you to be at my house Monday night, 6:30. Bring your 12 and 12 in your big book. I want you to read the first chapter in the 12 and 12, which is on the first step. And I want you to read from the very beginning of the big book through the doctor's opinion. Highlight what you agree with, what you disagree with. If you've got questions, go ahead, write it in the margin. It's your book. We will discuss this when you show up at my house. And I'm looking at this guy and I'm thinking, I'm not going to do this. And some of you know him, Bill knows him. He's got this lazy wandering eye. It just drifts up and to the right. You know, it's just like one of these things, you know. So this guy's weird, right? And what I said was okay. And as soon as I said okay, he turned around and left. Because he did not give me the opportunity to reconsider. Now I've done the work. I've done my little homework, and I show up at his house. I got my books. It's 6:30, and I sit down with him. He tells me a little bit about himself. He asked me about me. I told him my newcomer plan, which he thought was hilarious. And then he says, okay, open the book. Let's start reading. And I'm like, no, I did the work. I'm ready to discuss it, like you said. He said, no, open the book. We're going to start reading at the beginning. He's like, no, really, I did. I showed him the book. I got the highlighting. I got the questions right here. Because they didn't read. This is not written well. You know, I can fix some of this, right? And he's like, no. What we're going to do is we're going to read this book from the very beginning to the end. We're going to go word for word, line by line, paragraph by paragraph through the whole book. And my first thought was, oh my God, this is a level of lameness that I never thought was possible, you know? And I'm delusional and I'm judgmental, so I rapidly come to the conclusion that my sponsor, he's got to be an idiot, right? He probably can't even read. But I'm beaten into a state of reasonableness. I got nothing, so I'm going to read. And I'm thinking, I probably helped the guy. Help him work through some stuff. I found out later my sponsor has a master's degree in nuclear engineering. He was the chief technology officer for one of the largest gaming companies in the world. He retired a few years ago. He's doing fine. And he reads real good. He reads real good, you know, but I got nothing. So I sit down with him and I read this book. And what happened to me, my experience was when we got to a prayer, we said the prayer. When we got to a step, we worked the step, and it saved my life. And it changed me. It transformed me. And I never thought that was possible. Ever. And if you're new and you're thinking it's not going to work, I am not trying to be mean or cruel, but we really don't care what you think. We really don't. You know, it wasn't read tonight in the 112 meeting, but one of my favorite lines is, therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind, not the body. It's on page 23. That's the problem. I mean, obviously, the not drinking thing, it's a moose. It's a big deal. We really highly recommend that you stop drinking. But the problem that we find is that once you stop drinking, it gets worse. And then we start thinking. And the more we think, the more we want to drink. So somehow we have to change the thinking. And what we do is we don't say to you, okay, here we got this thinking problem. So huddle up, let's gather together, and we'll work our way through this thinking problem. We're going to think our way out of this. That's not what we do. What we do is we ask the new man to take certain actions that he probably doesn't agree with or believe in. We call them the steps. And then when he does that, when he looks back, he's been changed. He's been transformed. And it works every time. Every time I've gone through the steps with somebody, it works. We don't always go all the way through, but every time we do, it works. So I'm going through this process with my sponsor. I'm meeting with him on a weekly basis, and I got the, you know, powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable. Obviously, I've asked this guy to help me. So I'm going to help. He's going to help me manage my life, try to figure out what's going on. We get to the second step, you know, come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. I'm not stupid. I know we're talking about God, you know. And he goes, yeah, you're pretty quick. He says, well, don't you think it can work? I said, I don't know. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. He goes, you think I'm doing better? I said, yeah, you're doing a lot better. And he asked me, he says, is it possible? I said, well, anything is possible. He said, well, that's enough. We're going to get into this in more depth, but, you know, that's enough. And then, but we get now toward step three. I got to turn my will and my life over to this thing that I don't really understand. So I'm talking to him about this, and he says, what do you think about God? I said, well, I keep hearing these people tell me find God or die, and I don't want to find God. I'm kind of hoping he doesn't find me. You know, I've read ahead. I know there's a fourth and a fifth step and an eighth and a ninth step. I did a lot of bad things out there. This isn't going to go well. And he said, well, what's your concept of God? And I explained it to him, and he kind of laughed, and he said, look, in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you have a religious or a spiritual background, we have no dispute with that. We actually encourage you to go deeper or further with that. If you're having a problem drinking, we're just suggesting you lay the steps over whatever your practices are. But if you've got a problem with God, you know, use it as a placeholder for an experience you haven't had yet. And he told me, he said, the word God appears over 100 times in the big book. You'll see creative intelligence, universal mind, higher power. At one point in time, Bill refers to God as my newfound friend with a capital F. Don't you want a friend, Steve? yeah, I know you're tricking me, right? I'm not stupid, right? He takes me to page 37 in the 12 and 12. That's where the acid test is. The acid test is a real simple test. It goes like this. How is what you're doing working for you? I'm like, well, not too well. I'm sitting here talking to you, right? And he goes, well, why don't you try it our way? And so I did. You know, and I said the prayer, but I got to tell you, when I did my first third set prayer, it didn't mean what it means to me now. I was just afraid. I was just moving through it. Now, I found out later on page 88 in the 12 and 12, there's the same acid test. It's when you're in step 10. So after you've done 4 through 9, and you're in your 10th step, they ask you the same question. How is what you're doing working for you? In every instance, it's always better. Because AA is practical. It works. If it didn't work, we would not be here. That's a fact. So I asked him, well, how will I know if I've done a really proper third step? And he laughed and he said, well, you're going to do this your whole life. But a good general indication is if you start writing your fourth step. Now, if you're new, sponsors are tricky like this. They just keep trying to push you into the next step. So I write this fourth step. And my sponsor, there's a lot of different ways to do a fourth step. I'm not here to tell you how to do a fourth step. There's guides. There's all kinds of stuff. I'm a wordsmith. I'm a lawyer. I'm a pain in the butt. My sponsor knew that. He took me to page 65. He pointed out that on page 65, there's where the three columns are. There aren't even complete sentences there. Okay, it's like bullet points. You don't have to. He says, if you want to do your life story, I'll be prepared to listen to it, but I would prefer it if you just follow the outline in the book. In the first column for resentments, all you got to do is identify the resentment, the person, the institution, or the principle. Two or three words. That should do it. Second column is the cause. Just two or three words. That's all you need. The third column is the condition or how it affects you. Is it self-esteem, pocketbook, security, ambition, personal relations, sexual relations? Just jot that down. And then he said, if you flip over to page 67, there's not a fourth column, but we'd find it easy if we do a fourth column. And it talks about mistake, fault, and blame. These are character defects, selfishness, self-centeredness, self-seeking, dishonesty. The 12 and 12 refers to the seven deadly sins, pride, greed, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, sloth, some of my favorites. And then there's fear. That's in the big book a lot. And then on page 67, there's this discussion. Sometimes it's referred to as a prayer to the sick man. Am I willing to ask God or a higher power to help me show patience, pity, and tolerance to this person I resent? He gave me the instructions on the fear inventory and the sexual misconduct inventory. He turned me loose. He said it should take you a few weeks. It took me about 5 or 6 weeks. 2 or 3 weeks to think about it and 2 or 3 weeks to do it. Because like the book says, it's simple but not easy. The simple part's the instructions. It's right there in black and white. The not easy part is me and my ego, which tries to separate me from you and from God. But I finally get this done, and I got this inventory, and I show up at his house. I'm going to read my inventory. I'm going to do my fifth step. And for the new guys in the room, I'm going to tell you the first person on my inventory. Just so you can see how simple this process can be. So first person, I'm resentful at, two words, my father. Second column, the cause, two words, deserted me. Now, like the book says, Michael's prepared for a long talk. He asked me some questions. I explained to him, I'm 4 or 5 years old. I'm growing up in Las Vegas, Nevada. It's the early 60s. My father is in the Air Force. He leaves. He goes to Vietnam. He doesn't die there, but he stays there for quite some time. He does a couple tours in the Air Force. He joins an outfit called Air America. He meets a Thai woman, Lian Thong, marries her, apparently before he divorces my mother. I have a half-sister, Peck. I've never met Peck. I've never met Lian Thong. And I have 37 when I get sober, 38 by the time I'm writing this inventory. For the last 3+ decades, I've heard from my father a handful of times. A couple letters, a couple phone calls. That's it. He deserted me. What does it affect? Everything. Self-esteem, pocketbook, security, ambition, personal relations, sex relations. I mean, other than that, it's going pretty good, you know, but it's one of these overriding resentments that I, as the person describing it and telling it, can't see, but my sponsor identifies it right away. It's impacted all my relationships. I have no idea that, but he knows this. He knows this from the very get-go. Now I got to my fourth column. I got to identify my character defects, and I write down that I'm angry. I'm still angry. 38 years old, I'm still angry. I'm afraid. What am I afraid of? I'm afraid of relationships. I loved my father. And in my mind, I gave him a certain amount of power. He has abused that power. I will not let that happen again. There has to be a wall of insulation between me and you and you and me. I can't let anybody in my life. It's not safe. And then finally, I am not going to forgive my father. There is no way I am doing the prayer to the sick man to my father. Not going to happen. So I get done. I'm going on to the next person, and Michael stops me. He's like, okay, I want to make sure I understand this. Okay. So if I understand this correctly, your father deserted you when you were a young boy, and you've got some residual anger, you've got a lot of fear, and you don't want to forgive your father. I'm like, yeah, that's right, Michael, and I've read ahead. I know there's a ninth step. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Nope. He goes, look, we're just doing the fifth step tonight, but we're going to get to that eventually. He goes, I have a few more questions. I want to make sure I understand this. I'm like, okay, what is it? He says, well, when you came to me, you remember you had that plan, that newcomer plan? Says, yeah. He says, you had some passports. You were going to go to Costa Rica, right? Yeah, right. And you've got a wife and you've got a daughter. Now, you never said to me that you were planning on deserting your wife and daughter, but is there a functional difference between what you were planning on doing and in what your father actually did? My first thought was, this is not going the way I thought it was going to go at all, okay? And I put my head down and I muttered something to the effect, well, I mean, if you look at it that way. And that's why in the fifth step we admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs, because I can't look at it that way. I need somebody, in this case my sponsor, to hold a mirror up to me to reflect me back to me. Now, this is not a happy occasion. I believe it's a spiritual experience, not like the white light kind of experience, more like a black light experience. What do I mean by that? You've ever seen the crime movies where the guy gets murdered, right? The detectives come in. They bring in the plainclothes officers. They put the tape up. They cordon it off. They keep everybody outside. Then the crime tech, the CSI, comes in, and they got a little toolbox. They open it up. They take out a substance called luminol, and they spray it all over the wall. Then they turn off the lights. They turn on a black light, and what you can see in luminescence against the wall is the blood spatter, the evidence of the crime. And what happened when I did this inventory and I read it to my sponsor was the evidence of who I'd become, that I'd actually become my father, was out there in the open. It was clear. And this is not a happy occasion. I'm not happy about this. I go through the rest of the inventory. I go home. I get quiet. You know, like it says on the bottom of 75, on 76, I do 6 and 7, very superficial pass of 6 and 7. They mean a lot more to me now. 6 is a lot about willingness. 7 is a lot about humility. I have very little of either, but I said the prayer. Now I got to do this. I got to do this 8-step list. I'm looking on page 76 because my sponsor wants me to do an 8-step list. And on page 76, it says we have a list of those we've harmed and to whom we're willing to make amends. We made it when we did our inventory. And I am thinking, crap, if I'd have known that, I would have never put my father on the list, right? But like I said, I'm a lawyer, right? So I just take him off the list, right? No problem. I take him off the list, right? Now I got a list. Everybody but Dad's on the list. I show up at my sponsor's house, and he apparently doesn't trust me. He says, let me see the list. So I show him the list. He looks at the list. He says, your father's not on the list. I'm like, yeah, you're right. I told you he wasn't going to be on the list. He says, do you think you're any better than your father? I'm like, no, Michael. I got it. And by the way, thanks for pointing that out to me. He says, what do you think of the Lord's Prayer? What? The Lord's Prayer. We say it a lot at the end of the meeting. I don't have a problem with the Lord's Prayer. He goes, well, what about that clause in the Lord's Prayer? It goes like this. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. What do you think of that? I think it's a damn trick question. That's what I think, you know. And he's like, look. He says, you understand that principle, right? So yeah, I got it. He goes, do you believe it? Yeah, sure. Are you willing to do it? No, not with my father. He takes me to page 99 in the 12 and 12. That's where the 11th step prayer is. It is through forgiving that we are forgiven. What do you think? Yeah, makes sense. You willing to do it? Absolutely not. Not with my father. Not going to happen. He says, well, look, step 6 and step 8 are a lot about willingness. Are you willing to pray for the willingness? I'm like, sure, no problem. He goes, okay. You pray, I'll pray. Meanwhile, start making amends. I go out, I start paying back the money. I make amends to my wife. I am back in the big bed. I don't quite have the crossover privileges that I think I deserve. But, you know, things are going better, right? I get into this active 10-step process, right? I'm trying to make prompt amends. I'm doing the evening review that it talks about on 86. I'm trying to pray and meditate. I'm trying to get into conscious contact with this thing that I don't really understand. right? And by the way, one of the things that my sponsor told me about this God thing is, because I was having difficulty with this in the 11th step. He asked me, he says, do you like music? I said, sure, I like music. Do you know anybody that doesn't like music? I said, no, pretty much everybody likes music, Michael. He says, what kind of music do you like? I said, personally, I like blues and rock. He said, all right, if you were talking to somebody that liked country western music or jazz or classical or punk rock, would you insist that they have to listen to the music that you like to listen to? I said, no, that doesn't make any sense. People like the music that they like. You like the music you like. He goes, well, that's exactly, that is precisely like the concept of God or a higher power in Alcoholics Anonymous. All we are doing is suggesting that you get into rhythm and harmony with a tune that makes sense to you. You get to pick the tune. Then he asked me, he says, do you ever sing in the shower? I'm like, well, that's kind of a personal question, but yeah. Yeah, I do. He goes, well, do you always know all the words to all the songs? No. He goes, absolutely. That's exactly the point. If you just hum along, you'll get in tune. And that's been my experience. I sponsor quite a few guys. I got guys who are Protestant. I got guys who are Catholic. I got guys who have converted back and forth. I've got guys who are Jewish, Buddhist, Hindu. I have one guy who's a Druid, like Stonehenge. I don't get it. I don't have to get it. I got guys who find a God of their understanding on a surfboard out in the Pacific Ocean. Guys who find it walking through the woods. I have one guy who's Jewish. He likes Buddhism. He calls himself a Buju. It's all good. It's all good in AA. And like I said, I'm going through this process and I'm trying to practice the principles in all my affairs in step 12 and I'm trying to carry the message, and apparently some of the guys are hearing it because I got all these guys that are asking me to go through the book with them. I'm going through the book with them. They're doing the steps. They're getting a year cake. They're staying sober. They're now sponsoring other guys. I got this whole merry band of miscreants going along, but I am not making amends to my father. And this goes on for a period of years. And every 3 or 4 months, you know, my sponsor will ask me, how's it going? Good. You know, you've been praying and meditating about your father? Yeah, I have been. What are you hearing? Nothing. Not hearing a thing. It's all right. So one day I'm having a conversation with him and I'm explaining to him that I'm not going to be around a while. I have to go up to Anchorage, Alaska to do some depositions. And I'll be gone. I'll miss my home group. I'll be back in a maybe 4 to 5 days. He gets all excited. He goes, man, that is great. You'll make amends to your father. And I had forgotten that I told him my father was living in Wasilla, Alaska, which is about 30 miles outside of Anchorage. There's somebody here from Palmer. It's on the other side of Palmer. Yeah, you, Tony. And now I know my sponsor's connecting two clearly unrelated dots. And I got to tell you, if you're new, they'll do that, right? So I'm waving him off. I'm like, whoa, no. No. This is business. This has nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. And Michael says to me, he goes, Lamb, everything has everything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. He goes, you've been praying and meditating, right? I said, yeah. He's like, God's talking. Can't you hear him? I'm like, no. He goes, look, you pray and meditate every morning. I want you to do this for the next week or so and report back to me. See if you get any. So I'm like, so I do that. After a few days, what happens to me is I realize I got to do this. And it's not like God talked to me. The bush didn't light on fire or anything like that. I just realized this is something I needed to do. In part, I think, because I realized I'm a hypocrite. I got all these guys that I'm sponsoring. I'm having them go forth to make amends, and I'm not doing it. So I go to Michael. I go, okay, I'll do it. I'll do it. What do I do? Without skipping a beat, he goes, I don't know. I'm not going up there. Talk to God. I'm like, oh, man, you're killing me. You know, Bill knows him. I used to call him the cosmic cupcake, the mystic muffin. You know, it didn't matter what the question was. In Michael's mind, the solution was always pray and meditate, ask God for guidance and direction, and then you have to wait. You have to be present, like Curtis said. You have to be in the now. And there's no other place to be. And he reminded me, he said, God, whatever he, she, or it is, does not wear a wristwatch. It's not involved with time constraints. You have to wait. You have to be patient. And he told me, he said, you know that guy that you've been reading inventory about that you're irritated, he shares the same thing in the meetings every time? Yeah. Well, he might talk to him before or after the meeting. He might have the answer. Or you might get it in the grocery store. You know, when you're walking down the aisle, some lady's talking to her kids. That might be the answer. Your job is to be present and to wait and to listen. So I did that. I didn't get an answer, but I called my father and I he said he would see me, and so I'm flying up there. I don't know what I'm going to do. I really don't know what I'm going to do. But I've made a commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to see my father. I'm supposed to make amends. I still have this feeling in my, I don't like this guy. And I don't want to do this. And I got up into the airport and I walked through the terminal and I saw my father. And he was older than I remembered, obviously. He was shorter than I remembered. And he was kind of shuffling towards me. He was uncertain. He was clearly uncomfortable with this. And I'm just striding towards him with purpose because I've made a commitment in AA. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. But I figure, you know, God's in charge. I'll just go up. And before I could even think about what to do, when I got up to my father, I just grabbed him and I hugged him. Just like I did with many of the men here today. And my father buried his head right here on my shoulder and he cried and I cried and forgiveness occurred and all I had to do was show up and get out of the way. Now, I made more formal amends to him later. I had some discussions with him. I acknowledged that I wasn't the son that I should have been, and I asked him if there was anything I could do for him, and I made a formal amends. Now, he did not make amends to me. He's not in AA. He doesn't have to. But a father was restored to a son and a son to a father, and it was really I never thought that that could happen. Oddly enough, my relationship with my wife got better after that. My relationship with you got better than that, and it's not like I, you know, was in this great relationship with my father, but I didn't have that feeling in the pit of my stomach. It was okay. I could talk about my father. I've been up there to see him. He's been down to see me. It was okay. It was okay. And then a little over a year ago, on January 18th of 2021, he died. He'd been sick for quite some time. He had congestive heart failure. He was in the hospital. And because of the COVID protocols, I couldn't go see him. Liam Thong couldn't see him. Nobody could go see him. But he could talk to us on the phone. And we had showed him how to do FaceTime, okay? So we would talk to him on the phone. And my father was 87, almost 88. He wasn't very technologically proficient. So we would tell him that, you know, you need to hold the phone up to your face because it's FaceTime, right? But he couldn't hear very well, so he would hold the phone up to his ear. So I'd have, you know, 2 or 3 hour conversations with my father's very hairy ear. They get very hairy as they get older. And before he died, he made amends to me. Yeah. It wasn't a very good amends. I mean, you know, really, if he'd have been my sponsee, it wouldn't have been the way I would have instructed him to make amends. But he's not an AA. This is my father, you know? And in his way, in his time, he made amends. And it was perfect. And before he died, he said he loved me. And I said I loved him. And I meant it. And that's because of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's because of you. Not because you talked to me about forgiveness. Because you walked me through it. Because you showed me. And I got to tell you, I know that this thing works. I know that this thing works for amends and forgiveness. And I know that because almost 6 years ago now, I got shot. And I've been shot before. But when I was shot before, I was in the Army, and it was kind of a minor flesh wound. But this time, it was pretty significant. I was up in an area called Badger, California, which is a nice, beautiful area. It's next to Sequoia National Forest. It was a Saturday morning. I'd had breakfast, and I'm back in my little cabin minding my own business. I'm sitting on the bed. And the gentleman that was upstairs from me decided it would be a good time to clear his Glock 9mm weapon, which is ordinarily not a problem, but he missed a rather critical step. He forgot to remove the magazine. So when he pulled the slide back and released the slide, he jacked around into the chamber. He pointed it at the floor that he was on, which was the ceiling above me, and he pulled the trigger. That discharged around. It went through the ceiling above me. It entered right above my chest, right here above my heart, and it lodged in my sternum. Now, I will tell you, this will get your attention. Okay. And I went in the bathroom. I grabbed a towel. I checked the entry wound. I didn't have an exit wound. I got this towel over my... And basically, the first words out of... I yelped kind of a shortened version of fire truck. Okay? And I'm holding this bloody towel over my chest. And the guy from upstairs comes running downstairs. He comes around the corner. He's like, "What happened?" "You shot me. That's what happened." Now, he starts freaking out, which is understandable. He's had an accidental discharge. There's a guy that's bleeding. I'm sure he's very concerned about me, but he's also probably concerned about the potential criminal liability involved here, right? And then a really weird thing happened. I started trying to calm him down. Yeah. I wasn't angry with him. I went right to forgiveness. I was concerned about his welfare. And that is not me. This happened right before my 20th AA birthday. If this had happened 20, 21 years earlier, I would have been 10 different shades of pissed off. I don't know what your idea of a justified resentment is, but getting shot, that ought to be pretty high on the list, right? But because Alcoholics Anonymous, that's not my state of mind, right? But I've been shot, so I got to go to the hospital. I said, well, look, man, you got to take me to the hospital. So he takes me down the hill, a little town called Visalia. We go to Cahuilla Medical Center. I go up into the emergency room, and they ask me, can we help you? I'm thinking it's pretty obvious. I got this bloody towel on my chest, but I tell them I've been shot. Now, when you tell them you've been shot, you go right to the head of the line, okay? And so they got me on a gurney, and they got 12, 13 people attending. They do an overhead x-ray to find the round. They hook me up to an EKG, and after about 15, 20 minutes, the cardiothoracic surgeon is like, I don't know how to tell you this, but this round went within millimeters of your heart. It missed all your major arteries. That I don't even know how that happened. It's lodged in your sternum. It's immobilized. The bleeding has stopped. So we're just going to kind of observe you for the next 2 or 3 days. Then we're going to kick you loose, let you go. He says, but before we do that, you need to know that when we did the EKG, you have this thing called an atrial flutter, which is your heart is spasming. And you need to get this checked out by a cardiologist. You might need medication or some kind of treatment, or you could have a stroke and die. So I'm like, okay. So I go down. After a few days, I get released. I go see my cardiologist, Dr. Carlson. He does an EKG. And he confirms, he says, yeah, you've got an atrial flutter. He goes, but look, there's a procedure we have. It's called a cardioversion. And it works most of the time. You've seen in the movies how they'll take paddles and they'll paddle a guy, they'll shock a guy. And I'm like, yeah. He goes, well, that's barbaric. We would never do that to you. What we're going to do with you is we're going to tape these pads to your chest that are hooked to electrodes. And then we're going to hit you with a jolt of electricity. That will stop your heart. We will wait 5 to 7 seconds, and then we'll hit you with another jolt of electricity. That'll restart your heart, and hopefully it'll be in sync. And I'm like, you know, Doc, I am not that quick on the uptake, but that sounds like you're going to kill me. He's like, no, we don't like to look at it that way. Really, it's a control procedure. I've done it hundreds of times. You'll be in the hospital. I'll be the attending physician. And by the way, before the procedure occurs, there will be an anesthesiologist that will give you something that will make you comfortable. You know where I'm going with this. I'm alcoholic. I go from you're going to kill me to I am going to get comfortable. Yeah. And by the way, if you're new, it's not that I haven't been comfortable in AA, but I haven't been that kind of comfortable, you know, in 20 years, right? And I figured this is a free pass, right? My sponsor will be cool. I'm like, Doc, sign me up. Let's do this thing. So I got the gown on. You know, I got the IV in, and Dr. Carlson's here, and the anesthesiologist walks in. He's got a syringe of comfortable. And I'm watching him all the way across the room because he's my new best friend, right? You know, and I remember he was leaning over. I think he started talking to me. And the next thing I remember is Dr. Carlson's leaning over. He's like, how you doing? I'm like, I'm good, Doc. He goes, well, how do you feel? I feel fine. I'm ready. Let's do the procedure. He goes, no, the procedure's done. We did the procedure. We think it went okay. And I'm like hell, where was the guy who was going to make me comfortable? The guy with the syringe. Remember, you promised I was going to get I am arguing with my cardiologist about general anesthesia. Only an alcoholic does that, you know? If you're young, you won't understand this, but in the old days when they would give you general anesthesia, they can't count back from 100. You know, you go 100, 99, 98. We're hoping for 99 or 98, like my old grand sponsor Scott Redmond used to say. I'm waiting for 99. They got this stuff called propofol now. They think it's good dope. We totally disagree, okay? This propofol is like you're here and then you're here. There's no 99. Very disappointing. But in addition to the forgiveness and amends part of this, the other point of this story is, if you're new, hopefully you'll really get into the big book and the 12 and 12. And in the 12 and 12 in chapter 10, there's a discussion about the various forms of inventory that we like to do. But it also talks about what we're doing here, right here. It talks about retreats. A lot of AAs like to take the occasional retreat away from the clamors of the world. They want to go to a safe, secure, serene environment. Maybe have some fellowship, talk to somebody, do some spiritual work. But it's a safe, serene, secure environment, right? I got shot on an AA retreat. I was leading the retreat. I'd given a talk on Friday night on unity, which I thought was very compelling. Apparently, he was not paying attention. I got shot Saturday morning, and that evening I was to give a talk on acceptance and forgiveness. But here's the best part. The guy that shot me, I sponsor him. I sponsored him then, and I sponsor him now. And that's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's because of the steps, and that's because of forgiveness. And that's because I've had a psychic change and don't see things the way I used to see things. You know, my friend Bill C. says that we come into AA, we like to take off the clown suit. We do. But we don't throw it away. We hang it up. And we take it out from time to time. And I'm going to tell you some of the times that I did that over the course of the next day and a half. The point is that we're not saints. That we're not perfect. That we'll never get there. But we keep striving. And Alcoholics Anonymous is an interesting place. Because it's not a self-help place. It's like the island of misfit toys. And everybody's getting well, but nobody's working on themselves. We're working on each other. We're working on each other. And I like to think of AA as God's amusement park. So just bear with me for a while. I get the seriousness of the clown nose. Yes, thank you, Darren. Thank you, Tim. You're in the amusement park. It's God's amusement park. You're in AA. You got alcoholism. You paid the price of admission. It's very steep. It's very steep. Nobody asked you if you wanted to pay the price. You've got alcoholism. You just paid it. Now you're in the park. And in God's amusement park, you look around, you'll notice that there's meetings. There's sometimes off to the side, there's retreats. But you'll also notice there's these 12 rides in the park. They call them the steps. And if you look around and you look at the people, the people that are going to meetings, they seem to be relatively happy, but the people by the rides are just goofier than crap. I mean, they're just having a great time. They're having a lot of fun. Now, you don't have to stay in the park. You can leave the park. But if you leave the park, it's like a very, very, very high-end parking structure. There are no in-and-out privileges. You're going to have to pay another price of admission. And the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous are littered with empty chairs of men and women who could not or would not pay that price. But you're in the park. Have a great time in the park. Go to the meetings. Go to the retreats. But pay attention to the people by the rides. Because you'll notice what they're doing is they're saying to you, come on, take the ride. And if you take the ride with these men and women, what they'll do is they'll tell you when to throw your hands in the air and hoot and holler and have a great time. And they'll also tell you when to duck and cover because you'll have to do both as you go through the process. But if you go through that process and you take those steps and you take those rides, what you'll find is that you're going to be by the rides one day. And you're going to be looking at people and you're going to be encouraging them to come take the ride. And you'll never leave the park. And you'll never have to. So I hope you take the ride. Thanks for having me.